Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. This episode features Janet Brown. Her lecture, Darwin Revisited in the 21st Century, was part of the first annual Dorothy Schwartz Forum on Art, Science, and Humanities. It was held on November 15, 2014, and focused on the topic Why Darwin Matters. Janet Brown is Aramont Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. She has specialized in reassessing Charles Darwin's work and speaks here about Darwin's private life and his enduring presence in 21st century culture and science.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much. Good morning, everybody. I could also say it's my first time in Maine, so I'm delighted to be here. So, Charles Darwin was born in 1809, as you perhaps know, on the same day in February as Abraham Lincoln, and in the same year as Alfred Lord Tennyson, the poet, and the composer Felix Mendelssohn. None of these three, of course, had any idea that they would become as famous as they are now. And in Darwin's case, he's possibly more famous now than he was even in his own lifetime. Two centuries after his birth, and 155 years after he published The Origin of Species, there's no question about the extent and depth of his impact. Most people here today will recognize his face, and most people know that his name now stands for the theory of humans descending from apes, as in this very well-known image, many, many variants on this image, from chimp to human. We know this. And his theory has become very widely understood in the public imagination. For example, there's a whole load of things and objects that are named after Darwin. There's a city named after Darwin. He didn't actually visit there, but it's in northern Australia, and it was named for him by one of his previous colleagues on the Beagle Voyage. There's a high-level computer program named after Darwin. There's a Dutch rock band named after Darwin. There's a mountain in the United States named after Darwin, and another in Tierra del Fuego, where he visited. There are foodstuffs and drinks named after him. And there's many ways to display your various kinds of allegiance. A car, license plate, a little more adventurous would be to have a tattoo to demonstrate your adoption of Darwin's theories. And of course, there's numerous ways to draw on our perception of what the theory of evolution is about. So he's spread very widely in popular culture. He also, of course, has intellectual responses, and you can certainly add to this dissemination in the public world a dash of atheism, as we have here, the new atheists on organized free thought. Darwin will learn you. On the Origin of Species is what's being said there. You can add atheism, you can add a touch of gender, and certainly if you've been to Britain recently, you'll know that Darwin turns up on the £10 note. He will be taken off that next year, and Jane Austen will go on instead. But he's had a good run, he really has. So what I wanted to address today was, what do we as interested public, concerned public, make of these high levels of visibility in the 21st century? To some degree, of course, we're seeing a media phenomenon. It's not an intellectual one, it's a media phenomenon. For better or worse, Darwin's become a brand name. He's become the symbol of evolutionary theory and all that goes with it, in much the same way as the double helix of DNA has become a symbol, a ubiquitous image to represent modern genetics. Now, I'd like to propose that the primary reason for Darwin's prominence is surely the excellence of the theory. It's a magnificent achievement. It lives on as the central organizing concept of modern biology, as first expressed in 1859, forever ago. It's astonishing that this theory still has the power to move and to work and to be explored on the Origin of Species, 1859. At that time, the clarity and the insight of Darwin's vision, it did provide some real answers to the biggest natural history problems of his day. And even Alfred Russel Wallace, the other man of the evolutionary story, who independently formulated the same idea as Darwin, same time, using the same sources and almost the same words. Alfred Russel Wallace was a man who really shouldn't be forgotten. He said that Mr. Darwin has given the world a new science, and his name should, in my opinion, stand above that of every philosopher of ancient or modern times. The force of admiration can no further go. That's a pretty sweeping remark. Here is Wallace amongst some of the other evolutionists who were thinking about that problem at the time that Darwin was writing. We mustn't forget that Darwin was one of several who proposed evolutionary theory in the middle years of the 19th century, and it was Darwin's theory, Darwin and Wallace's theory, that went forward with to be critiqued and accepted in to some degree, and has over the decades become the theory that we now believe is the true theory, certainly an accurate theory. So since 1859, Darwin and Wallace's jointly formulated theory has been expanded, it's been developed, it's been restructured from the bottom up with the advent of what we know now about genetics. And despite all these changes, it still continues to demonstrate remarkable explanatory power, and I really think it's an astonishing accomplishment. So if we go back in our imaginations to Britain in the middle years of the 19th century, cold, wet, crowded, dirty, unhygienic, it does become clear that Darwin's lifestyle was that of a member of the prosperous and well-educated classes, and that his outlook was very conventional. Nevertheless, his mind soared above the conventions of his day to formulate very far-reaching ideas about the connectedness of all living beings and our animal origins. It's a bit of a difficulty. We would expect someone to, the person who wrote The Origin of Species, we would expect them somehow to be more revolutionary in their private life. But Darwin wasn't. He was completely and rather charmingly conventional, and yet the mind goes out into areas where other people hardly dared to go. And much of what I've attempted to do in my scholarly writings is to try and recapture that extraordinary combination of private conformity and public notoriety. How could Darwin do what he did? Is it possible to get under all those layers of fame and celebrity and see his life as he may have lived it? And what do we find when we look back with the advantage of hindsight from the 21st century? And that was my theme for today. So I'd like to start with the private Darwin and what sort of a man he might have been. Crucially, Darwin believed, as we do still today, that the Beagle Voyage was the making of him, the turning point in his life. It was this that changed him from a pleasant but rather aimless young man into an inspired and creative thinker. As he said in his recollections, "The voyage of the Beagle has been by far the most important event in my life and has determined my whole career." Here is the Beagle, an image, a watercolor taken from another Beagle voyage. There were three Beagle voyages. Darwin was on the second, and this is an image from the third Beagle voyage by the captain, who was clearly very talented, taking this sketch in Sydney Harbour in Australia in 1841. So we see from it that actually this boat is very small. It's a three-master, but nevertheless it's really rather cramped quarters for a five-year voyage, which is what Darwin ultimately made. For him, this voyage was full of exceptional sights and opportunities. He was a young man from the town of Shrewsbury who had traveled no further than Paris for a three-day holiday with his family. So to go around the world is just astonishing. It would be astonishing for us today still. The impressive landscapes of South America, the fecundity of tropical Brazil, dramatic encounters with indigenous peoples and other ways of life, hazardous travels off the beaten track, exotic islands. It triggered countless moments when his imagination and his ambitions were powerfully stirred. And his letters home show him always ready to grasp an opportunity. He was inexhaustibly curious. He was cultured, he was friendly, he was adaptable, and he had no shame in asking his father to send another bank draft to help him look up the things he wanted to look up. He really made the most of this opportunity. He could shoot, he could ride horses, he had lots of stamina, and he was eager for adventure. So, in intellectual terms, he was mostly interested in the geology that he was encountering. Here is his own map from the archival collections in Cambridge in England, with his colouring indicating the geological regions of South America. It wasn't the first time that someone with geological interests had visited this enormous area, but Darwin was working from a textbook that was presenting very up-to-date geological theories that were actually drawing on Europe and Eurasia. So Darwin found that he could apply those ideas to South America and come up with a very fresh interpretation of the geology of South America, one of his main achievements, actually, scientifically, from the voyage. He was also very interested in the fossils that he managed to find. Here was one of them. He didn't find all of this, so he found some of the vertebrae, a few of the bits of the rib cage and some of the skull of this toxodon in what is now Uruguay. And wonderfully, I mean, creatively noticed that this animal, it's a mammal, fossil mammal, this fossil mammal was rather similar to what lived in the area at the time, the present time, and began to make those connections between past and present that eventually became real in his evolutionary theory. He also found some of the remains of this guy, the Glyptodon, who you will immediately recognize as being like an armadillo, and indeed Darwin did too, so that he had traveling on the boat with him in the crates of fossil remains, evidence that he would then put towards an evolutionary theory later on. His mind was not that of an evolutionist for the most part during the voyage, but these facts that he was discovering, these ways of thinking about nature, were priming him to feel that evolution might be a useful answer. He was also very interested in the humans that he encountered. Here is, it's no humans in this one, but in Tierra del Fuego, when the boat was surveying all around Tierra del Fuego, the primitive peoples, as he described them, were very much in evidence. And here is a beautiful image of Tierra del Fuego by the artist who was on the ship with the beagle, if you can see it right in the center of these very dramatic cliffs. So Tierra del Fuego was important for him because he came across various tribes there, various indigenous peoples. He was very interested in their culture. They were almost living on the edge of humanity, he says. They had very little culture, except they could build huts, which you see in the background on the left, and they had clothing, and they made canoes, and they had fire. He was unable to penetrate any beyond those simple observational facts. But there were three such people on the ship, on the Beagle ship, that had been captured on the previous voyage and educated in England, basic education in England, and were being returned to Tierra del Fuego in order to set up a Christian mission. They had been Christianized. So here we have a classic instance of some of the English colonial activities. Three indigenous peoples had been taken from their homelands, brought back to London, Christianized, Protestant Christianity, Christianity and were going to be relocated, and a mission was going to be built for them in Tierra del Fuego in order to convert the rest of the population. It was a hopeless endeavor. It didn't work. But on the ship, there were those three Tierra del Fuegans, those three Fuegans, had become just like Darwin. They could talk English, they used knives and forks, they wore proper clothes, and were of great interest to Darwin. So when they were relocated, landed back on Woollya Island, and the mission was built, it seemed to Darwin, he made notes about it, it struck him that here was Jemmy Button, the gentleman on the right, was almost a different species of mankind, and yet he knew these were his relatives. These were his literal relatives, his brothers and sisters. So that too, like the fossils, unsettled his sense of what it was to be a human and what it was to be an elite Englishman. All the properties that he had understood to be inbred into him, he discovered were only relative. So that was another element of the voyage that was really important to him. And of course, we know the finches on the Galapagos Island, or at least his visit to the Galapagos Island, was terrifically significant as well. I'm not going to talk about the finches too much, except to say that Darwin, as you I'm sure know, he hadn't given any thought to the possibility that the birds, the tortoises, the lizards, were in any way specific to individual islands. He assumed it was an island archipelago, they would all be much the same, and when he collected, he put his organisms, the plants included, all in the same bag and just labeled them Galapagos. It was only after he got back from the Beagle voyage and the ornithologist who looked at his birds said to him, "I think these are all separate species. Have you got the names of the islands where they came from?" That Darwin said, "Well, actually, no, I don't have the names." And he had to run around to his colleagues who had been on the ship to ask if they remembered. Of course, Darwin knew which islands he had been on, but he wanted to find out from his colleagues if they had collected any birds that he could then show to the ornithologist to work out which islands they came from. These things are the stuff of historians' careers. We work on these moments. We try to find from the materials left behind how somebody becomes primed to think of new things. And then, of course, we're very lucky if there are notebooks or letters or any kind of record of the moments of creativity that strike an individual. And we know, in the classic sense, that Darwin both had to have 7 or 8 years of wondering before he then was committed to the idea of evolution. And even then, after the commitment, it took him some time before he could come up with a mechanism to explain it that satisfied him. So the process of creativity for Darwin was a long one. It was really only after the voyage back in Britain from 1836 onwards that he began to engage very seriously with the idea of evolution. It was very challenging. And after 2 years of very hard thinking and wide reading, he unexpectedly came across the concept of differential human survival in the economic works of Thomas Malthus, Essay on the Principle of Population. Malthus wrote about the ceaseless reproductive pressures, the competition for survival amongst humans, and the famines and diseases that Malthus believed would regularly reduce the size of the population. And this inspired Darwin, as you will know, to propose that favorable variations would tend to be preserved and the unfavorable ones to be destroyed. And the result of this would be the formation of new species. So Darwin put all these kinds of thoughts, their private thoughts, in notebooks such as these. He was a big notebook chap. And here is his very first commitment to the idea of evolution. It's a very famous diagram. He didn't actually have that Malthusian structure behind his thinking when he drew this diagram, but nevertheless, it is a very famous and interesting image. And he rethought the finches at that point with the information given to him from the ornithologists in London that actually maybe the diversity that he now knew was the case in the Galapagos Islands represented one form, or two forms, breeding pair of original organisms that had reached the island archipelago and had diversified according to the foodstuffs, and that they had remained separate for so long on the islands that they had actually become separate species. So it's a very big moment for Darwin. And he recorded in his autobiography that here then, I've found a theory by which to work. So we tend, as scholars and readers, to emphasize the private work that Darwin put into developing this theory in his notebooks. And I'm wanting to turn now to Darwin as a private figure in another way, and then as a public man. He did spend a great deal of time after he arrived back from the Beagle Voyage in establishing himself as a public figure, as a gentleman scientist. He published his Beagle results. He joined a few professional societies. He also became a well-established geologist. In 1839, he married his cousin, Emma Wedgwood, and soon afterwards he moved to the countryside in Kent. And what I wanted to show you is something of the man himself, because before he proposed to his cousin, he thought very seriously about whether he should get married or not, and here is the classic scientist's way of approaching a big event like a marriage. He wrote it all down. And this is a marvelous resource for many, many different kinds of inquiries, but here it is. Marry or not marry? This is the question. And you won't be able to read it from where you're sitting, but I can tell you it's divided into two ways, like a balance sheet or an account, that there's the good things on one side and the bad things on the other side. So not marry is on the right-hand side and marry is on the left-hand side, but they get a bit confused in his mind. So on the not marry side, he wrote down what he imagined to be all the disadvantages of getting married. So he says he would lose freedom to go where he liked. He would miss the conversation of clever men in clubs. However, he would not be forced to visit relatives. But there would be the expense and anxiety of having children. And of course, that's just, there's many other things that he mentions, like not being able to go up in a balloon. Which is an amazing thing that Darwin fantasized about, going up in a balloon. And on the marry side, again, he gets confused. He says it would be a terrible loss of time, but that it would be intolerable to think of spending one's whole life like a new-to-be, working, working, working. Only picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with good fire and books and music, perhaps. So the advantages are looking good here. There would be a constant companion and friend in old age who will feel interested in one. There would be the charms of music and female chit-chat. And some of you may know this text, but it is most remarkable that at this point he says, better than a dog, anyhow. And right down at the bottom, on the left-hand side, you might be able to read, it says, marry, 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 QED. And indeed, he did propose to his cousin. She accepted, and they had a very happy, long-lived marriage. It's actually a wonderful marriage. It works very well for both of them. They lived in London for a little while, and then they moved to the country where they stayed for the rest of their lives. This is a very charming watercolor from the back of his home. If you can see the little black blob down at the bottom left, that is actually a representation of Darwin. It was taken in his lifetime. He married He was prosperous. His father advanced his inheritance so that he could live as a gentleman. He had no need to have a job. Always remarkable when one thinks of that, that he nevertheless gave his life to science and worked. He both could manage to work completely on the things he wanted to do, but he, having decided he would write about evolution, he gave his life to writing about evolution. They had children. They had 10 children in the end, three of whom died in childhood. And that made Malthus's principle of population suddenly very real to him. And he became an invalid, which is always more surprising. He suffered from very poor digestion and nausea. Possibly it was exacerbated by nervous tension, maybe stress related to the ideas he was working on. But nevertheless, during this period, he'd never lost sight of his theory of evolution by selection, natural selection. Here is his study in which he did most of this work. It was a little bit like the Beagle in a metaphorical sense. It was his cabin. He could regulate his time because he was the Victorian center of the family. He was the paterfamilias. He could choose exactly when he wanted to engage in social interactions. And one significant consequence of this was that he actually began to depend very extensively on correspondence. He withdrew to the countryside. He actually withdrew into this little room and maintained contact with the rest of the world through letters. Here is a contemporary Victorian illustration of letters, but I would like to stress that Darwin used them as a research tool. That was the way that he could find out things. Of course, he had books sent to his home, which he would read, but he would then consult with colleagues all over the world about the accuracy of what was being said in the books, and would exchange opinions on the experiments he was doing in his home and garden, and also, as the pressure to publish mounted, he would talk about his theories in very private terms to a few friends. Some of the work that he did during this period is directly related to the fact that he was a private, prosperous gentleman, that he could attend to things that perhaps many scientists of his period wouldn't. He was very interested in his children as research objects, for example, and much later in life managed to bring all his observations together in a book called The Expression of Emotions, where he managed to draw parallels between human children and chimps in this particular instance, that the expressions, it's more, his theory was more than just showing the origins of plants and animals, but he, of course, wanted to talk about human origins as well, which he didn't do in The Origin of Species. And his researches tried to show that the human mind clearly had developed from a more or a less sophisticated mind in animals, and that even the emotions were the same between animals and humans. So we have images such as this where the children feature, and indeed his children were very much part of his household. The manuscripts of The Origin of Species, Darwin drafted and redrafted all the time, and so some of those old manuscripts were repurposed by the children to put their own stories on the back, and that it's hard to know why we have them. We know Darwin kept the drawings, as we all do, of our children. The reason why this manuscript was kept was because of the drawing, and yet for us as historians, we have on the back of it a page of the original manuscript of The Origin of Species. So it's a fantastic paternal pride is emerging here. So Darwin made his home and his garden into his laboratory. Yet, of course, the reason he's celebrated is because of The Origin of Species. It was controversial from the start. Here are the several editions of it in well-worn form. These are not Darwin's, but they are from the Cambridge University Library collections. it was produced in this intensely domestic environment. Yet the theories in here were very controversial, as you know. You will see that on the left there's a caricature of a gorilla from Punch magazine in 1861 asking, "Am I a man and a brother?" And the question of ape origin was the thing that everybody wanted to discuss after The Origin was published. The scientists had scientific issues with the theory, the way Darwin had presented it. It was not completely obvious to scientists that this was the answer. It took 150 years for that to be completely plain. Darwin had no theory of genetics. There was very few transitional forms, both in the present day, to point to and say, there you are, that's evolution. There were hardly any transitional forms discovered yet in the fossil record. So he was working against a waterfall of, it's counterintuitive almost. And yet, much of the response, even including the response from scientists to this book, was to ask about human ancestry. So if this is true, are you really suggesting that we descend from apes such as the gorilla? Darwin didn't put that in his book, but that was what the controversy was about, with all its associated questions about, do you really think that the Garden of Eden is not a valid concept? Are you really saying that the book of Genesis is a metaphor? Are you really denying that the soul was put into individuals by a divine force? Darwin got letters and letters and letters about these questions, which he responded to as best he could. Those were his views, but they were not expressed publicly. They were expressed publicly, however, by very many debates, such as the one between Samuel Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford, on the left, and Thomas Henry Huxley, a scientist and a friend of Darwin's, on the right. In 1860, there was a very public dispute between the two of them that brought those issues exactly to the fore. And I can perhaps tell you a little later about what was purported to have been said in the debate on the public stage at Oxford. And Thomas Henry Huxley, on the right here, went on to produce a book called Man's Place in Nature, in which he produced several images, but this one is the most famous one, which is the origin of all these images that we see today going from chimp to human. It provided a kind of thematic motif which evolutionists and anti-evolutionists picked up on ever since 1863. So Huxley contributed to the debate very forcefully, publicly, whereas Darwin was still privately at home. There were a great many comments in magazines of the time, not just in England, but of course in America and in France and in all other English-reading countries. Darwin was translated very quickly into the major European languages. By the 1870s, he could be read in 10 different languages. It was a global debate by the 1870s. Here is a cartoon from a French periodical showing Darwin, recognizably Darwin, with the beard and the receding hairline. This is quite an interesting anti-Catholic cartoon as well, is that the circus hoops that are being held up are labeled credulity and superstition. And here is Darwin representing the force of reason and rationality bursting through these traditional forms of belief in the here Catholic Church. And Darwin had many supporters. They were American, Asa Gray on the left from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gray was the main gateway for Darwinism to reach America. Thomas Henry Huxley, looking like a heartthrob, second from the left here. Very, very energetic bulldog for Darwin is how he liked to characterize himself. The gentleman in the middle, Charles Lyell, was older than Darwin and probably at some point a little more famous than Darwin. He's been eclipsed now. Lyell was the geologist whose book Darwin had taken with him on the Beagle voyage and who became a close personal friend, and Ernst Haeckel on the far right, who took Darwinism to Germany, basically. So three, four, five, six, several very significant supporters who went out and about and did the public work for Darwin because they believed in the theory. They had some reservations about things, but they nevertheless believed that this was a rational, non-spiritual, non-supernatural way of thinking about biology. So I've focused exclusively on the 19th century. I just want to bring us up to the present day. Here is a chart that some of you will be familiar with, perhaps, from 2006, that shows something of the state of opinion in a number of countries, nations, about evolutionary theory. It is being updated at the moment because in 2009, it was the bicentenary year of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species being published. So 2009 is a date that is useful for people who compile charts and plan celebrations. Here we have a chart dating from 2006 where people had been asked, did they believe evolution was true, or did they believe evolution was false, or did they not know? And you will see how it pans out. The writing is a little small, but Iceland, all the Scandinavian countries are up at the top as having the largest proportion of the population believes in evolution. Also a rather small sector of the population who don't know, which says something about the scientific education in the Scandinavian nations. Going all the way down, you can see that there are many countries who are not here. Japan is not here. Oh, Japan's two, four, five, fifth down. Right down to the bottom, I'm afraid you will find the United States and Turkey as having the largest proportion of people who believe that evolution is false and the largest proportion of people who don't know or aren't sure. And this is something we will want to talk about at some point today, that why might this be so? Is this our science education? Is this a rise of belief in creationist or alternative evolutionary views? Or is it something else that we simply can't put our finger on at the current moment? So I'm wanting to close now. I think that the contrast between the wide circulation of Darwin's ideas, popular ideas, generate contrasts. Darwin was a vigorous young man, but very frail and reclusive in later life. He was a traveler and a thinker. He was a loving father and family man. He was a good friend to many figures who were both secular and members of the church. He was modest, but able ruthlessly to construct a worldwide network of supporters and helpers to keep him supplied with information. And he was a man who was very domestic in his habits, and yet he also wrote The Origin of Species, a book that's reverberated through the centuries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janet. Janet has been very willing to take any questions you might have, so please jump right in.
Hello, I have a question coming from a musical point of view, over here, sorry, which is, you've showed us the picture of Darwin's cabin, and I'm interested in the relationship to this, as to the maybe the drawing room environment of the house, and whether or not his wife had a similar space, and I imagine with a piano and things, and what part and how, what was the kind of osmosis between these two areas in terms of the activity in the house?
Thank you. What a lovely question. So homes in the Victorian era were mostly female, so to speak. It was a female space. So there was a drawing room, a very comfortable drawing room with a grand piano, a Broadwood, because Emma Wedgwood, she had been taken on the girls' equivalent of a grand tour. And I don't know if it would be, well, she took a few lessons from Chopin, but I'm not quite sure where that would have been. Would that be Geneva, where she spent most of her time, or Paris? Was he in England? I'm afraid I don't know. We should talk about that. She was not bad musically, not terrific, you know, so it wasn't Chopin saying, please come and learn with me. So I dare say he had to sell lessons. But nevertheless, she could play a lot of Beethoven and a lot of Bach, a lot of Haydn. So the space in the drawing room was Emma's space. Her domain was that and the nursery and the kitchens over which she had control, basically. Darwin's space was Darwin's space. So the office, the study, was his space. And the children were allowed in, but they had to knock. And we have all kinds of anecdotes about how they loved to go into father's study because he would let them play with all the scientific things that he had. And there's a marvelous description of Darwin did a lot of microscopical work, and he had to do that next to a window in his study because of the light coming in to fall on the slides, the microscope slides. And to do that, he had a stool with wheels on it, which he would move to the window. And the kids remember being allowed to sit on that wheelie stool with a walking stick and punting themselves around his room. So there's lots of lovely stories about Darwin being a father and allowing them into his room, but it was nevertheless his space. So you're absolutely right. There's very little blending of those two spaces.
Somewhere along the line, I think it might have been on a PBS at back in 2009, that his wife was extremely devout and that he was sensitive. She was not sure about this, and that he held off on publishing out of tenderness toward her, or it was something like that, that it was not an agreement from her point of view because of her piety.
Thank you. Yes, it's a terrific question about the religious relationship between the married couple. And I fear to say that I think some of the piety that is represented, that Darwin's wife held, is overstressed in order to make a dramatic case. Darwin was never an atheist, so he would have respected his wife's views, and he did respect his wife's views. We know that. He was very tender and thoughtful about her views, but she's kind of a practical. She was Unitarian by upbringing, so, which, as you perhaps know, is already one step away from from the more conventional kind of piety. Okay, so there you are. So you know that you're a very rational person. You're kind of engaged with your religion and with the work, the intellectual movements of your day. So I think it's overemphasized. It's there. It's quite right. She continued to be a Unitarian for the rest of her life. She did go to church. She may well have prayed for Darwin's soul, but we know very little about that. What we do know is that Darwin... She wrote to him when they were just married. She wrote to him to say, I think your scientific questioning, the mode of mind that you have now about always questioning everything, isn't going to be helpful when you're thinking about faith. Couldn't you read a particular set of the chapters from the Bible? In fact, it was from John. She wanted him to read some of John. And he does it. And I don't know what their conversation was. But he writes on the edge of that letter. He keeps that letter, tucks it away, because we still have it. And on the edge of that letter, he writes, know that I have kissed and cried over this. So they clearly had a loving and tender relationship. He may well have not published early in order to help his wife. We know she read it in manuscript. She helped him with all his punctuation. But she would never have said, don't publish this. And I think he was so committed to that theory, he would still have gone ahead.
The chart that showed the difference between the Darwinian believers and non-believers, mm. is quite remarkable, but maybe not. When you think about the homogeneity of the Scandinavian countries, so there's no real other to be afraid of, versus the United States, which is the great melting pot, which is one of our great strengths, but also has created a lot of ethnic and racial conflict, where therefore I don't want to be like that guy, you know, and so forth. I wonder how other scholars view that disparity.
Thank you. It's not just the chart. Of course, this whole question has excited a great deal of attention from a great many lines of thought. So the scientists have been investigating the rise of creation science for a long time now. There were court cases, not, of course, the Scopes trial way back, but there have been a succession of court cases in different states, not always southern states, about the right to teach an alternative to evolutionary theory in the schools. We're the only nation that does that. And I think it, apart from the points of view that it represents, I think we have in America a political structure that allows parents to have a bigger voice in the educational programs of their school system. It's very unusual in other nations that are, of course, not so large, that they would mostly have a centralized educational system, probably delivered from a department of the state. So I think there's more opportunity in North America for popular points of view to be expressed in the school curriculum, which is one way of answering you. And secondly, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that to sound satirical. And it's a huge country. So some of the issues that were aired in 1860 and 1870 are still current in the United States in ways that are absorbing for scholars. So I don't really want to go out on a limb and to say what I think, but I do think it's a real interesting issue that you're raising that we can talk about in the break.
Going back to what you were talking about in relation to his wife, how did Darwin reconcile his own Christianity with his theory later in his life as he settled on how evolution really worked?
So again, it's a question that has engaged a lot of scholarship. We know that Darwin, as a young man, had expected to go into the church. So he had been, first of all, intended to go into medicine, a good profession for his family. That his father was a doctor, his brother was a doctor, his grandfather was a doctor. So he went off to take the beginnings of a medical school university education and found that he was not suited to that. He attended an operation and just said he couldn't do this. So he went back to his father, who then sent him to Cambridge in England, which was the it was not really a school for science at that point. It was training young churchmen. And Darwin went through the university program in Cambridge in order to then read for the church. And it was at that point that the invitation to go on the Beagle came, and his father allowed him to go. And it was on the Beagle voyage that you can see in Darwin's letters home the shift into wanting to be a scientist, an intellectual, and give up the church. He never quite asks, could he do that? But by the time he comes home, it's clear that everybody in his family understood that he would not be going into the church. And it was on the Beagle voyage that we know that he says somewhere to one of his friends that he was still a believer on the Beagle voyage in all the classical parts of the Protestant Unitarian faith. And progressively through his London years and through his early years, as a married man with children, he gradually lost all sense of the doctrines, but he never quite relinquished the sense that there must be something else somewhere in this world, some force but it didn't work in nature. That was his key point, that you can look at nature completely as a thing that has no purpose, has no origin from the divine, that it is just as it is. But that doesn't stop him, nor did it stop a lot of his readers, from still thinking there may be something else that perhaps has some overview. Yeah. So it's kind of tricky, because he says different things to different people. But way back, way late in his life, his friend Huxley, who we saw on the screen, invents the word agnostic in order to describe Huxley's beliefs, and Darwin is very relieved and says, that's what I am too.
In the Punch cartoon, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to this question about race and evolution, mm-hmm. the Am I Not a Man and a Brother is this is on the Wedgwood,
yes.
The abolitionist motif, and it says that, and it's wonderful because of course she was a Wedgwood, and they putting that on the ape brings the whole racial thing in. Of course, it would have been thought doubly funny by some people at that time. But that Am I Not a Man and a Brother was one of those things that caught on. I mean, Rochester says that to Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting that they brought that Wedgwood commemorative right in there. And I think it, from the beginning, that tinge of racism was there in the public discussion, certainly not in the scientific discussion. And I think that it has carried over, but it's an awful carryover. I also just was pleased to see that Wedgwood Museum has been saved, which means all those Darwin plates are still yes. going to be on,
yes,
which is wonderful.
Thank you. So, yes, it's a real comment on the image I showed with a gorilla with a placard that said, Am I a Man and a Brother? Like all cartoons, or what we now call cartoons, caricatures, it pulls on several different social contemporary motifs in order to make the point. And so I do think the anti-slavery elements of that are very explicit, and the racial implications of that are also very explicit. In the United States, the racial aspects of Darwinism were, in fact, taken up straight away. The possibility that Darwin was suggesting that humans not only came from apes, but there were intermediate stages in which the African Americans would lie, was a motif that became very widespread very quickly, and is something that's taken a long time to remove. Yeah.
Professor Brown, you stated that Darwin married a cousin, and I'm wondering if that, in the plethora of children they had, that more limited gene pool manifested itself at all, and did he comment on that?
Yes, he did. There was some discussion with his father about, who was a doctor, should he marry his cousin? And the result was, yes, of course, go ahead. So when Darwin had three of his children die, of course he worried about that. And he worried very much about the remaining children, who were rather sickly, and did attribute that possibly to them being more Wedgwood than Darwin. which in genetic terms was actually true. So yes, of course he worried, but actually only one of the children died from something we don't know about. They had a child who died at the age of 3 weeks, so, and nothing is said about her, but we don't know, but she did die. Could have been any kind of purple, could have been any sort of early neonatal fever. There was a child who reached the age of 10 who then died of some terrible Victorian fever. It's often said that that really put the nail in the coffin of Darwin's religious belief, that why should a divine or benevolent creator remove a lovely child from the world. He does say that. And the third child that died died of scarlet fever. So they're all typical Victorian deaths that surely had some meaning to Darwin, but I'm not sure that he took that medical meaning from them.
Professor Brown, I wanted to ask you about the contribution of Wallace to the development of the theory of evolution. It was, if I remember correctly, didn't he go on the journey with Darwin on the Beagle at that time? And what was his role in the development of the theory of evolution?
Thank you. So this is a question about Alfred Russel Wallace?
Yes.
Who is, as I always like to say, a really important figure in the Darwin story. So he was a naturalist coming from a very different social background from Darwin, who traveled in different regions. He went to the Amazon and then much more extensively into Malaya and Indonesia. So he was in the Dutch colony island of Ternate when he thought of the idea of evolution by natural selection. He had been reading the same things as Darwin. It's quite extraordinary. It's the most amazing moment in the history of science. And had been thinking about the same kinds of geographical and historical problems as Darwin. So he came up with a theory. It was beautifully expressed, much shorter and more succinct and powerful than Darwin's writings, which went page after page after page after page. Darwin never found it easy to compress. Wallace was simply brilliant and managed to do that straight out. Sending his essay to Darwin, who he already knew by correspondence, Darwin hadn't any idea that Wallace was doing this and was completely shocked at receiving in the mail his own theory written by somebody else who he hardly knew. So that moment was resolved in a very gentlemanly fashion. Darwin didn't want to give up his theory. He'd worked for 20 years on it. When pinch came to shove, it was actually a slightly different theory. So he asked Lyell, his friend, what to do. And the result of that was that Lyell and others decided, they read all the papers, they decided the best thing to do, the most honorable thing to do, would be to jointly publish them, which they did in July 1858, a small paper in a scientific society, which generated no interest whatsoever from anybody. And then Darwin really set to write On the Origin of Species, which was his big book, which came out, which was the thing that caused the controversy. Wallace was still away. Wallace didn't come back until 3 years after The Origin of Species was published. And it was when Darwin sent him a copy of The Origin of Species that he made those remarks that I cited at the beginning. So the relationship between them was initially tense, and then afterwards honorable, generous, and respectful.
One more question, then we'll take a break.
The successor book on the Descent of Man, I'm wondering whether that came strictly from Darwin's own continuing to think, or did it come from pressure from the outside, questions and probing from other scientists?
So it's a wonderfully interesting book to read. Darwin's Descent of Man, published in 1871, so that's 15 years after The Origin of Species, and in it he claimed to put all the theories about human origins that he had had, that he had worked out. He said in one of his letters that he wanted to do this book because, first of all, he'd been accused of not saying what he thought, and he wanted to kind of remedy that. But he also was busy reading the works of all his friends and supporters and other people, and he felt that all his friends who were busy writing about humankind hadn't quite got it, that they weren't quite seeing it. So he puts everything he has into explaining his own ideas as they relate to humankind in The Descent of Man.
so that it's a it could not have been written in the form that it was written without the work of the other people. So he uses Huxley on fossil mankind. He uses Haeckel on the notion of embryology, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you so much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.